WYPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, the monthly installment of Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. It's the new year, so how you feeling? Are you optimistic that brighter days lie ahead, or are you worried? Does the election of Donald Trump mean that the country has embraced his notion that America used to be great and needs to be made great again? Or does it mean that dissatisfaction with the status quo is so deep that we were willing to elect a disruptor in chief? And how closely tied is the fate of the country to your perception of what your own fate holds in store? Are you optimistic about your own future? The Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen 11,000 points in the last 8 years. Unemployment is the lowest it's been in decades. But survey after survey suggests that Americans think we're not headed in the right direction. What does that mean? Sherry Parks will help us sort it all out when Midday begins right after the news. And Happy New Year, everybody. On 88.1, it's WIPR, and I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. You know, as 2016 came to a close over the weekend, many folks took stock of their lives and thought about what went well and what didn't go so well in the course of a very tumultuous year. So when you think about 2016, what comes to mind? An unpredictable and unprecedented election cycle, more shootings of people of color by police caught on tape, the second highest per capita homicide rate in Baltimore's history, terrorism rearing its ugly head here and abroad, the flame-out seasons of the Orioles and the Ravens, or was it your kid getting accepted into the college of her choice, the promotion that you got, the special anniversary that you celebrated with your one true love, that family reunion when you reconciled with your estranged cousin? Well, there's plenty of news that could, if we gave into it, lead to despair. But America, as it turns out, is a particularly not prone country to despair. We simply don't do despair. We are about as optimistic as they come. The Pew Research Center reported in 2015 that Americans are far more upbeat when asked if they're having a particularly good day than their peers in other advanced nations like Germany, the UK, Spain, Japan, and France. So many people on the political right, even those who did not initially support Donald Trump's divisive bid to become president, were thrilled when Trump was elected. And of course, lots of people were shocked, dismayed, and depressed as it sunk in that the country has indeed elected Mr. Trump in November. But have Americans remained personally optimistic about the future, even though many in the body politic fear the unknown consequences of a Trump presidency? So today it's time now for another edition of Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. Today, a conversation about American optimism as this new year, typically a time for forward-looking resolutions, gets underway. Sherry's an associate dean for research, interdisciplinary scholarship, and programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland in College Park, where she is also an associate professor in the Department of American Studies. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Happy New Year. It's good to see you.
Hi. Happy New Year to you, too.
So did you dance the night away on New Year's Eve?
Actually, I didn't. I stayed in.
You stayed in?
Yeah.
Because you and I ran into each other at some event somewhere. It was like one of those gala things, and you were cutting a rug on the dance floor. I made major note to self, never dance with Sherry. She will show me up bad on the dance floor.
No, it's not a competition.
I'm way out of your league when it comes to the dance floor. Well, whether you're a dancer or not, you are welcome to join our conversation with Dr. Sherry Parks. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Again, the phone number, 410-662-8780. So, American optimism. It's interesting. You turned me on to an article that's about a year old, year and a half old, from the Atlantic magazine about this sort of inherent proclivity for optimism in America. What do you think about that? Is that a legit assessment?
Well, I think it is. And I love your intro because, I mean, this is a very long list of things to despair about. And actually, I like going against the grain, first of all. But then you led in, and we didn't talk about your intro. You led into, but what about your kid getting into college? Because really, this is about the relationship between the individual and larger context. And we are not objective about our lives. And so we're very much like, remember the old joke about the little girl and the pony and the pile of manure? And she's digging through the pile of manure and saying, they said, what are you doing? She says, because I know there's a pony in there somewhere. We are like that. And we will, we're supposed to look for the best part of it, make the best of it. All of these cliches are very, very important. It's tied to the American dream, certainly, that you're supposed to, that you should, not only that you can, but that you should rise above your context. And so it's not just the individual, but that the country. And if you, we're going to start talking a little bit about the election, but if you notice and you listen, you'll hear people making the best of whatever their outcome was, that this will galvanize the left, for instance, or maybe it won't be so bad, or maybe it will be great. I mean, so you hear people almost immediately working to get the best out of the situation.
The lemons out of lemonade school of thought.
Yeah. And as you pointed out, that list of countries that you pointed out, in many ways, the day-to-day lives of those people might be better than Americans. You know, in France now, it's illegal for your boss to make you do email at night. And yet, we are more optimistic.
So is that sort of part of American exceptionalism?
Yes.
Is that part of that narrative that says, you know, we're just different? The implication is clearly we're better.
Yeah, it's not just that we're different. It's that we're better. And that things will, that change, any kind of change, is change for the better. We don't really focus on change for the worst as a country. That thing will shake things up. You heard that before the election. We'll shake things up and it'll shake out to be better.
So when Sarah Palin in 2008, and to a lesser extent, or I guess the same kind of extent, her running mate, John McCain, when they used the phrase, we want our country back,
mm-hmm.
or in 2012, when we heard about the 47%, you know, from the Republican nominee, Mr. Romney, was that wasn't that also a call for change? Wasn't that also saying we've got to change things back to the way they were? And certainly Mr. Trump, in the last three elections, mm-hmm. Mr. Trump made that call and asked that question more loudly and more boisterously than either of the two preceding Republican candidates.
But if you dig into it a little, they say, but of course we don't mean to go back to the 1950s, although it might look that way, that there are going to be things that have gotten better for all Americans that we won't go back to. But what we want to, and when I say we, I'm not meaning me, I'm just paraphrasing. What we want is those things. We want America to be unequivocally the most important country in the world. We want those aspects of it. So you're right that there's almost a cyclical aspect of it, and certainly nostalgia. But nostalgia is never wanting what was. It's wanting an idealized version of what was. And so it's not memory per se. Does that make sense?
A little bit. Let me go back to something you said at the very beginning about objectivity.
Mm-hmm.
You said that it's impossible for us to be objective.
I said we are not. Yeah.
We are not inclined.
It's an ideal, certainly, especially for people like you.
because we do try. You know? But why is that so hard? I mean, what's the barrier to sort of getting an arm's length and saying, okay, here's really what's going on?
Well, remember that biologically we're still very much like our ancestors. We haven't changed very much. And think about it, you know, we are not at the top of the food chain. And so if something is coming to eat you and you are objectively thinking about your environment and you're seeing the birds and the trees and you're seeing the river, that's not going to keep you alive. What's going to keep you alive is that you see the most salient thing at that moment, which is that, you know, whatever coming to get you.
The lion or tiger,
right,
or bear.
Oh, my.
And you just start running.
Right. And you start running. And you've had this experience. I mean, you've had children. You know that at the moment when your child falls, nothing else happens. You zero in on that. and everything else, in my mind, things go cold. Everything goes, and you zero in on it.
That's for sure.
I think that's where the idea of a spotlight came from. It's like, and that's what's happening, is that we will think about the most, we will see, we'll actually, I'm saying we will actually perceive the thing that is most salient for us. And you can't remember what you don't perceive, at least consciously. I mean, we pick up all kinds of information, don't pay attention to it. And that's what I mean, is that we are not objective in that sense. We select constantly. What is the thing I'm going to pay attention today? Like right now, and this is radio and they can't see us. You and I are looking at each other's eyes. You know, you're not looking at my feed or, you know, whatever. Why? Because we're communicating. I want to say this. I don't want to say, you know, that sort of thing. And so that's what I mean, is that we're not objective. And so that means that we can select if, you know, the worst thing that can happen, and you mentioned about children graduating. During the recession, I had a number of undergraduates who wanted to quit school because the family lost the store or the restaurant or whatever. And I said, no, go back, ask them, because your graduating may be the thing that saves this year. And they said, but I could work. I said, wait, emotionally. And that's what I mean, is that
there's income and there's psychic income.
Right, exactly. And we're constantly sorting and taking care of ourselves in that way. And if we see ourselves in a really bad situation, I mean, think about survival. If you find yourself in a really bad situation, do you just float down the river or do you try to swim upstream? And so we're constantly trying to swim upstream.
Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland. It's Culture Connections here on Midday. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So there's so many things about this election that are fascinating, obviously, but one of them was the assumption from President Obama through the entire punditry class that the message that Mr. Trump was delivering was way too negative. You couldn't talk about the halcyon days of America being in the past. You couldn't talk about making it great again, because the obvious implication was that it wasn't great now, that you couldn't say that things are a mess and portray this nightmarish assessment of the economy and of foreign policy and of race relations and crime, et cetera, et cetera. You couldn't give that nightmarish assessment and bring people to your cause. It was, of course, in complete juxtaposition to President Obama's message, which was, there's no red states, there's no blue states, it's the United States, we're all in this together. Or Reagan's, it's morning in America. But Trump won. Mm-hmm. I mean, he won where he needed to win. He didn't win more votes than Secretary Clinton, but he won more states. So how do you explain that?
Well, let's dig into what hope looks like, because you're right that we think of morning America, and Obama to some degree was saying we are already wonderful. And actually, I mean, we are okay now, when there are people who knew they were not okay now. If you say vote for what we have now and you are in despair, and you're right, we don't do despair well. I mean, it looks like anger for us, and because this is not the way things are supposed to be. Think of the difference between those two things. I'm poor. I'm going to stay poor. My children are going to be poor. Or wait a minute, something's wrong here. And if we fix that one thing, I hope that things will get better. And so he wasn't doing that great when it was all doom and gloom. And then he started bringing in, this is what I think. You know, we're going to spend years digging into this. What I think I saw is that when the consultants came in, he added an up note. And it was a note that sounded odd to many people, because it was, trust me. It's like, your life is
really... Only I can fix it.
Things are really bad for you. I see that. Trust me, I'm going to make it better. And that's
And this moment dates from Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway joining the campaign.
I think so. I think so.
Towards the end of the summer.
And so in an odd sort of way, there was hope. Even there were people I talked to who knew some of the things that he said were really negative, but they had hope in the country. And you heard Obama say that, I have trust in the American people. They said, it can't be that bad. He can't make it that bad. you know, Americans are too good, we're too wonderful, we're too, there's too, the bureaucracy is too big, which is a kind of a jaded way of looking at it, that he cannot break us. And that's a certain type of optimism.
We'll talk more about optimism when we come back after a break from Midday here on 88.1. It's Culture Connections with Sherry Parks. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a look at some possible changes in how the State Board of Elections, or excuse me, the State Board of Education. That's different. Education's much different than elections. I've got to practice my reading. You know, this is my New Year's resolution. I'm going to learn to read the English language. The State Board of Education may approach the thorny problem of underperforming schools in some radical new ways. I'll be joined by David Steiner of the Johns Hopkins University School of Education and Liz Bowie, who covers education for the Baltimore Sun. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. More on this edition of Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks after a quick break. Sherry Parks is an associate dean for research, interdisciplinary scholarship, and programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park. She's also an associate professor in the Department of American Studies. She wrote a terrific book. You should read it. Make that your New Year's resolution. Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. More of your calls and comments about how you're feeling as this new year gets underway when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We'll be back in a flash.
You're listening to Midday here on your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on! Always look on the right.
It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us this hour, we're talking about the future and how we're feeling about things in our personal lives and in the larger sense of the direction that the country is headed now as Donald Trump prepares to take office in 2.5 weeks. It's this month's installment of Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. She's an associate dean and associate professor at the University of Maryland. She joins us every month with her takes on all things cultural. So how are you feeling about the new year? What's your relationship to hope, as it were, as we start 2017? What are you hopeful for? What do you fear? Give us a call. Let us know. 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, again, @MiddayTomHall. So in 2014, Sherry, something called the World Values Survey, according to this piece by Jared Keller in the Atlantic Magazine in March of 2015, says that an average of 36% of Americans said that they were very happy over the last 10 years. 36%. So it's about a third. And we beat out on the happiness index folks in Japan, Chile, Poland, Germany, who were evidently less happy than we were. So, you know, I use the example of the stock market for people who are invested in the stock market through their employer, through their 403B or something like that. I mean, it's gone up 11,000 points since President Obama took office, and it's gone up many hundreds of points since the election, since November of last year. So there are people who are feeling financially more secure than they felt certainly 10 years ago or 8 years ago. But there is this dichotomy, isn't there, between how people feel on their about their personal lives and how we feel about the sort of the body politic in general. This election was an earthquake. I mean, it put so many people on the left in absolutely utter despair and what could be only I could only describe as a semi-collective depression. But that doesn't necessarily indicate that people are worried about what's going to go on with them personally. I mean, is that
Yeah, well, and I mean, they are clearly related. I mean, we live in the world, but often, do you remember cocooning, that whole after 9/11 when Americans went into their homes and added to their homes and watched a lot of movies? We have ways of coping and making ourselves regain a certain equilibrium. Now, go back to what you were saying about other countries a second ago, is that I'm always suspicious of anything that asks Americans if they're happy or not, because we're supposed to be happy. And that idea that we're supposed to be happy is, one, going to change how they may answer. In Germany, it's quite all right, you know, to not to be happy.
It's kind of like that poll question when they say, is the country headed in the right direction?
Right.
What does that mean?
Yeah, and which direction is that? But I do think Americans are default emotion is supposed to be happy. And that's actually new. Our grandparents did not expect to be happy. They expected to be content. Now we're supposed to be even more upbeat than that. And we will work at it. And we will, there are lots of ways, music is one of them, that we will use to change our mood to back to what it's supposed to be. Food, alcohol. We have all kinds of ways of doing that. But your deeper question about the relationship between the individual and the world is an interesting one, because it's not a dichotomy, but often people will be in despair about the larger world and not in despair about their individual relationships and their children and their neighbors and their partners.
Because when it comes to individual stuff, it's a pretty short list. If everybody in your life is healthy, mm-hmm. if nobody's got cancer or, you know, dealing with a terrible chronic illness, if you've got a roof over your head, you've got a job that allows you to, you know, you don't have food insecurity, you don't have problems getting access to the health care you might need, and there's certainly a large swath of the public that doesn't have those things. There's all sorts of people in this city and in cities around the country and the world that don't have those things. They're in a different universe, perhaps, but the universe of people who don't have to worry about that sort of day-to-day survival stuff, you know, there's no particular reason to be unhappy, I guess, right?
Well, and if you look at American Studies is a study of everyday life. And if you look at the everyday life of people who are poor and surviving, is that they often have the ability to be thankful and grateful for what they do have. Just as you pointed out, that's a way of just getting through the day. And that's not to say that they should, I think in a macro level, they should be satisfied and, you know, say, oh, no, you know, things can be awful as long as my kids are okay. I'm just saying how they survive that day-to-day life is to be grateful for what they do have. And I want to double back to, because you asked a very complex thing, with the stock market, as you know, is very emotional. I mean, it often rides not on what things actually happen, but what people think is going to happen or how they feel about it. And the people who matter most to the stock market are the ones who are benefiting from the stock market. You know, even middle-class people like us, our pensions are based in the stock market. It doesn't benefit, for the most part, the people who are at the bottom of the economic ladder.
Sure.
And so in a way, it's irrelevant to their lives. And yet, I mean, there's a resilience that you see in working class culture that is tied to a type of optimism.
410-662-8780 is our number here on Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. Midday at WIPR.org is our email address, and our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall. So in this article in The Atlantic by Jared Keller, he introduces us to a researcher named Dr. Edward Chang, and he runs a great lab at the University of Michigan. I mean, you guys in academia are terrific at ginning up great names for labs. This is the name of the lab: Perfectionism and Optimism Pessimism Lab at the University of Michigan. There's a lab for this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They study this kind of stuff. Do you know Dr. Chang by any chance?
I do not.
Okay, well, I don't either. But so he says that actually explicit pessimism in American culture isn't really, really tolerated. You can't be explicitly pessimistic. That generally speaking, that's just sort of not allowed.
It's not polite.
And is that because we're and he perhaps credits it to the fact that we value independence. We value our own capacity to rise up out of whatever difficulties may befall us, whereas he talks about Eastern cultures valuing interdependence.
Well, in American culture, you're supposed to be able to rise above your pull yourself up by your bootstraps, rise above your context, make things better. Not only should you, it's fully expected. There's also in the public sphere in the United States, a mood that is tolerated. I mean, I don't know if you've lost a family member, but one of the things that many people notice is that even if it's you know, a mom or a partner, after a couple of weeks, you're not supposed to be openly mourning anymore. I mean,
get over it.
And so that's what happens. And so we're not saying necessarily that people are happier, but certainly they are demonstrating a certain level of happiness. And actually, what psychologists will say is that if you fake it until you can do it, is that if you work at optimism, you actually become more optimistic. And optimism has all kinds of benefits. You live longer, for one thing. You have a happier life. And so it's not just people deluding themselves. It's a certain type of outlook. And there are lots of people after this election. I think all sides had some type of optimism. And people who voted for Trump in his core expect him to make things better for them. People who held their noses because of some things expect the American public to be okay no matter what. And people on the left are saying, well, this is galvanizing the left so that the left will be stronger. There's no notice. There's lots of anger and despair in that. But then there's this note of optimism that's very interesting.
It's interesting. I think you were here the day that Mike Fletcher from The Undefeated, he's former writer for The Washington Post,
yes,
and he's now at Undefeated, which is the web platform of ESPN, which deals with the intersection of race and sports and culture.
Mm-hmm.
He noticed that, and this is right after the election, that 8 years ago, when President Obama was elected, the world was applauding the United States for this great leap forward, this great, we out of 320 million people, we found the one person who perhaps could, in fact, unify us. And, you know, he was an historic figure. And then 8 years later, there's so much of the world thinking, oh, my gosh, you've elected Donald Trump. He's a Barnum and Bailey, showman. He's a TV reality star, and he's nothing more than that. So what about optimism about the capacity of the American electorate? Because wasn't that in so many ways? And as you say, the folks who supported the president-elect are thrilled that he's been elected. And had Secretary Clinton been elected, they would have been just as devastated as the people on the left currently are. But what about people's questioning the capacity, the judgment, the basic judgment of the American
country? Well, I think we've had two earthquakes. I mean, in hindsight, we can look back and say that the election of President Obama was an earthquake for some people, too. And we've had 8 years of backlash to that. And so then there's another earthquake. But I think questioning the judgment of American people underneath that is there has been around the world a voice that said, but in America, all things are possible. In America, the individual can prove their worth. One Israeli said, you Americans are the biggest country of optimists, and therefore you're the only one. We were actually talking about peace and conflict. You're the only ones who can do. It was a very exceptionalist argument. You Americans can only do this because you're the ones who are that optimistic. Even if he didn't agree with the optimism, he thought that our optimism would drive us forward and we could actually get something done, maybe not everything done. Does that make sense? And I think we violated our own brand in the world.
Violated our own brand.
If Americans are optimists, if Americans, if that optimism is not only individual but national, and it looks like we responded to somebody whose message was pessimistic, we did not live up to our own ideals.
Because the message was America is in a mess, we need Mr. Yeah. Fix-It to come in and yeah. make all well.
And so I'm saying,
so they're optimistic. Do you think people are truly optimistic about Mr. Trump's capacity to make all things well again?
I think some people are. And so, yes, I think in
or
a way.
Or are they certainly optimistic about him blowing it all up?
Well,
he's a disruptor.
I think in some ways the people who voted for Trump actually did fulfill the brand because they looked around, they saw no hope. But in a savior, there is hope. If that makes sense.
Yeah. So they had hope, though. I wonder what the hope was for, because I know the folks who supported Mr. Trump, who called into this program when we would talk, when I would ask them, what does change look like? Well, I'm voting for change is what we would hear. And then when I would say, what does change look like? What do you want specifically to change? They were hard-pressed to come up with something.
Because they don't have to. If you believe in change itself, if you believe that change is good, despite the fact that change in your life, obviously, historically, has not always been good, then if you said blow it up a minute ago, if you shake up the system enough, it shakes out into a way that's better than it is now. The faith is in change and the change maker, not in the specific type of change.
What would you like to see change? What are you hopeful about for the future? What are you thinking about these days as the new year begins? Sherry Parks is here. It's our Culture Connection segment on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our telephone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a long piece in the Atlantic magazine
yes.
this month about a series of conversations and observations that he had about and with President Obama. And speaking of optimism, there was a time just a couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks before the election, that the Clinton campaign, the Obama administration, the Democratic Party in general was extremely optimistic mm-hmm. about the results of the election. Georgia, Texas were states that were said to be in play. They're talking about, you know, getting a mandate and making sure that, you know, the T's were crossed and the I's were dotted. The president was talking about in this 1 week, revelations came out about Mr. Trump that he'd lost $1 billion. In a single year. He hadn't paid taxes in perhaps as many as 18 or 20 years. His university that he was running was being sued left, right, and center for, you know, fraud. He had trampled on his own messaging, you know, day after day after day. The minute something bad happened in the Clinton campaign, an email, you know, revelation or something, he would go after a beauty pageant contestant on Twitter and distract everybody. And then there was, of course, the Access Hollywood tape. None of that mattered. None of it. I mean, he had more than enough worst weeks in politics in the history of the Republic, it seems, and he won handily when it comes to the Electoral College.
Because emotion can override rationality in making those kinds of decisions.
Was that emotion, do you think, premised in an optimism that he, this guy who was making all these mistakes, was it premised in an optimism that he could actually do better or just disrupt what was?
I don't think it was one thing. I think for part of the electorate, it was that he could do better. He knows the system. He can fix it. And then there were other people who thought they were blowing things up and that it would shake out in a better way. So I think it was both.
How about you? Are you personally optimistic now? I know right after the election, you weren't. I mean, it was a shock to you. We talked about it like the day after.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
That was November 9th, November 10th, November 11th. Those were quite
well,
the days.
Well, yeah, and personally, I will admit, I was hurting. It was hard. It's interesting. Since then, I spent a week in California at a Kellogg summit on truth and racial healing everybody was traumatized. And now there's going to be a racial healing day in a couple of weeks that the Kellogg Foundation is calling for. So I think.
So again, this is galvanizing.
Yes, yeah. I think that's galvanizing. Yeah, somebody said that they were at a march where there were fundamentalist Catholics who were Latino standing next to gay activists, and that wouldn't have happened. So, I mean, I'm doing the same thing. It's like, okay, somewhere there is light.
Dr. Sherry Parks is the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. She's an associate dean for research, interdisciplinary scholarship, and programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland in College Park. She also teaches in the Department of American Studies. She joins us every month, including today, for Culture Connections here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll have more with Sherry Parks after a break. Mary in Annapolis is up next, then Terry and Frederick. Stick on the phone. If you'd like to call us and join the conversation, 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Midday at WIPR.org is our email address. At Midday Tom Hall is the Twitter handle. We'll be right back. Stick around.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WIPR.
To accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, and latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In Between.
It's Midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, it's this month's installment of Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland. We're talking about hope in the age of Trump and the political dichotomy, or the potential dichotomy, rather, between hope that we may feel as individuals versus the sense of hopelessness that we have as we begin the Trump era. Trump's slogan was to make America great again, which assumes, of course, that it wasn't great before and that, as he said at the Republican convention, only he can fix it. So what do you think about that? Join us on the phone, 410-662-8780, on the internets at midday at WIPR.org, and on the Twitters at Midday Tom Hall. Mary in Annapolis, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks. Thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you for having me. My question is about cynicism. I feel like that is an ism that has been very prevalent, very popular in our country for a number of years now. I hear people constantly complaining about the government, about the way they do this, the way they do that. And I feel like that is the cause of a lot of it, because it split the left in the beginning. If you were a Democrat, there were two very strong divergent movements in the Democratic Party, and then it split the electorate in the election. People were just cynical. They don't want to fix anything. They, whoever they are, won't do anything right anyway. So it doesn't matter.
Yeah, drain the swamp. Well, that's a good point, Mary. Thank you for your call. I mean, cynicism goes back to cynicism about government in particular goes back nearly 40 years. I mean, the Reagan message was government is the problem. It's not the solution. And we've been handed a steady diet of the inefficiencies and the incapacity of government to make people's lives better for a long, long time.
That's true. I think there is a particular American turn on cynicism. I mean, true cynicism would be accepting that things are that way and that they're not going to change. It turns into anger, and people then act to try to change it. One definition of cynicism is frustrated or disappointed idealism. That you expected something. You mentioned perfectionism in the Institute a minute ago. You expect things to be great, and where they're not, you're disappointed. But in America, you don't stay in the cynic space. You then do something about it. So there's this attempted upturn, and I think we saw both. They're related. They're not opposite.
Getting back to American exceptionalism. Do you think that we are culturally oriented toward the future in a way that other people are not? Are we more futuristic than other cultures?
Yes. Yeah, so actually, there's a lot of evidence that we are. We're still a pretty young country. We don't have centuries and centuries, I mean, millennia of heritage to fall back on. And everybody who has come here, except for the Native Americans who were here at the beginning, came here based on either their or somebody else's hope, whether you're forced or free, that things would get better. And yes, we are very much a future oriented. We think much more about the future than we do about the past, or we're supposed to think much more about the future than we are about the past. You're supposed to be constantly preparing for the future. And that's not true in older societies.
And of course, race has everything, all and everything to do with all of this. I mean, it was an issue in this election, obviously, but it was an issue in every election we've ever had. I mean, and obviously, your notion of how you perceive opportunity, how you perceive equality to access to that opportunity is going to be informed by the lived experience you have, which in so many ways has to do with the color of your skin, does it not?
Well, I think one of the things that not just the election, but a lot of the activity around the election has shown us is how deeply woven race is into the fabric of the United States. I think we often thought with this change, progress, unilinear model that we often focus on, that somehow we were post-racial, somehow we had gotten past that, and there was no going back. And we really have not, as a country, turned around and faced what race is in the United States, what it means, and how much it informs the day-to-day lives of everybody.
Terry in Frederick, you're on the line with Dr. Sherry Parks for Culture Connections. Thanks for your call.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm glad that you brought up the issue of race, which is why I was calling. I think that when we talk about what is it that people have lamented the loss of, or what do they hope for, I think that there's a real kind of damage to this notion of white privilege that has taken place that we see, which has allowed people then, in many cases, to vote against their own interests, which is why you see working class whites, for instance, those coal miners in West Virginia who fear the loss of their black lung benefits, voted one particular way, and now they think, wait a minute, we may lose some of the gains that we got under this administration. Historically, this is nothing new. We have seen this kind of change of political office and this way of people aligning themselves racially with their vote after Reconstruction, in a period that people referred to as Negro domination, when there was a lot of black political power. We saw it at the turn of the last century with a number of white supremacy campaigns, as they were self-named, when they were trying to wrestle political power from African Americans. I think that's exactly the same cycle that we are in today. That does not mean that every single person who voted for Trump voted with that in mind, but I think that a fair number did vote with the sense that what I want is a return to me feeling that my privilege matters as a white person.
That's an excellent and acute observation, Terry. Sherry?
I very much agree with it. It actually predates Reconstruction. You saw it during the Civil War with the planter class convincing poor white farmers that white privilege was more important than affluence and that they should go fight in the Civil War. That's when it really kind of rises up as an overt strategy to use working class whites in that way. And you're right, that idea that voters vote against their self-interest is everybody. If you're affluent and you vote Democrat, you're voting against your economic self-interest. And so you have Americans routinely voting against what many people will perceive their most important self-interest, which is economic. I mean, we show that that's not the most important thing for most Americans. And that white privilege, which was seen as a birthright for generations and generations, because some people for whom the election of Barack Obama was an earthquake, was this damaging of what they saw as their birthright, that it somehow the promise of white privilege was somehow diluted or disrupted. And they want it back. What's really interesting, though, is that, you know, when you talk about the Coates article, when you talk about Obama, when you talk about me, what's different is there's so many of us now. And yes, we're kind of in the way of that, aren't we?
Yeah, indeed. I guess we've lost Terry, but I'm interested, Sherry, do you think that folks are voting in this past election against their self-interest because they're not aware of what their self-interest is, or are they making a conscious choice? I mean, if you're a wealthy Democrat and you vote, you know, for tax increases to balance the budget and get rid of the deficit, sure, you're going to pay more. So perhaps that's an informed decision. Do you think The level of information is the same in that coal mining town in West Virginia? Are they aware that it's not in their best interest? Folks used to bring this up at the Tea Party all the time, that the folks in the Tea Party, you know, get the government off of my Medicare, that kind of thing.
Although when you look in really into the demographics of the Tea Party, they were actually quite affluent. I think most people know. I mean, just because you're working class doesn't mean you're stupid.
And but were they willing to know that they were doing it against their self-interest and still do it?
I think people,
or did they, were they just confused?
I think people were voting for the country they wanted to live in, and they thought that that would make their lives better in other ways.
Bonnie lives in the country of Towson. Thanks for calling Midday here on 88.1. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just going back to the direction of happiness and being happy. And I made the point, and I've heard many times, the Constitution guarantees the pursuit of happiness. We're not guaranteed to be happy, and I think too many people are out there looking for happiness in the wrong places. Materialism, I think that's what a lot of addiction is about. We can't stand to live in our own world because we're not happy. And I think if more of us paid more attention to what other people need, and not so much what I want, we would be happier and more content as a society. There would be less prejudice. And I don't know what that would do to us economically if people stopped shopping. But the more and more we pursue happiness in the form of materialism, the more unhappy we are, because that's not going to be the happy place.
Well, thanks for your call, Bonnie. Certainly, happiness is defined in a million different ways by a million different people, is it?
Right. And material happiness is a particularly superficial type of happiness, and you have to keep reinforcing it, which is her point.
Kathleen in Ellicott City, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Thank you for taking my call. This is a worthwhile discussion. It always is. And there's lots of these discussions going on. But what I wanted to note is that a discussion in talking about the results of the election in a context that seems to say Americans voted this way, we have to caution ourselves, because this election is unprecedented in the degree to which it does not reflect the majority vote. And in my view, an important factor in that is the changes that have occurred in our election structure, so that what this election seemed to illustrate to me is the danger that we have of an election that doesn't reflect our majority, and the system that has been over the last, dozen years or so, has been altered and skewed and changed so that volume voting is now manipulated or controlled or ultimately doesn't have the effect we would expect it to.
Right. So it's about being hopeful about whether we can change the system. Of course, the Electoral College every 4 years comes up for grabs and comes up for discussion. And then we are reminded that there are states without very many people who really like the Electoral College, and they right now are running the show in that regard.
Yeah, I'm from North Carolina, and I think that conversation is arising there, where there was extreme gerrymandering, and people are now looking at that.
And, of course, Maryland is considered one of the most gerrymandered mm-hmm. states in the country. That's all the time we have. I'm awfully sorry we weren't able to get to Phyllis's call from Catonsville, but she says that she's a new American, and she says that outside the U.S., people are more hopeful than many Americans about the opportunities that America affords. So her experience is different than perhaps some of the polling. But I appreciate that call. Appreciate everybody who called today. And Sherry Parks, always appreciate seeing you. We shall see you next time.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherry Parks is an Associate Dean for Research, Interdisciplinary Scholarship and Programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland, College Park, where she's also an associate professor in the Department of American Studies. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. She joins us every month for Culture Connections here on Midday. That is it for us today. Tomorrow, a look at some potentially radical changes to the way the State Board of Education may address the problem of underperforming schools. How will education policy at the state level change now that a whole new cast of characters will will be shaping educational policy at the federal level. Liz Bowie covers education for the Baltimore Sun. David Steiner is the executive director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy. They'll join me for a conversation about what's next for Maryland schools tomorrow on Midday. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours can be found on the web, joesquared.com. Thanks to you for tuning in. You can catch up on shows that you might have missed at wipr.org/midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for spending part of your afternoon with us. Have a great day.